Blog Talk Radio.
Why don't we begin? Good evening. This is Miss Evelyn. Welcome to Heart Talk with Miss E on Tuesday, May 20th, 2014. Amazing. As we always say, as I always say, time is passing by very quickly. So, May, as you may have heard us say a couple of weeks ago, is a significant month on many levels. First of all, most of us are aware that here in the United States, this 2 Sundays ago was Mother's Day. And it is also National Foster Care Awareness Month. And this is one of the huge months of the year for me because with foster care and foster youth being my passion, it is something I try to celebrate, make people aware of and honor every day, every month, every week of the year, because our young people are not just visible during the month of May. They are here, and we need to make them parts of our lives every single day of the year and to acknowledge. And as I've stated here with For a Child's Heart, we usually put together a program which we call Foster Pride Awareness. And the importance of foster pride for me is to instill a sense of pride and a sense of confidence in our young people who have experienced being in the foster care system, because once having gone in, there's a lot of pressure, there's a lot of pain, there's a lot of embarrassment and shame that comes along with not just being in the system, but the circumstances which brought them into the system. And I want our young people to walk in a sense of confidence and in pride. And over the past 30 years, I have seen it over and over again to watch our young people just blossom as they grow into their full potential and become the people and recognize that they are the people and the gifts that have been placed on this earth to manifest. And I'm just so grateful for the privilege to operate and to work with and to love on my young people on an ongoing basis. And it's something that I want the village to be able to take into consideration and to take on the quest and the commitment and the compassion for loving our young people as well. May also happens to be National Mental Health Month. And as a therapist, and as I say in some of my speaking, like the hair guy people, I'm a client as well, I seek to bring a sense of health to one's mental and emotional well-being. And any of us who are trying to make a difference in the world or is trying to survive, we know that it is difficult sometimes to maintain a sense of mental clarity, to maintain a sense of emotional uplifting, and that is why it's important that we feed ourselves things which inspire us, which motivate us, which get us moving and keep us moving and staying on target into following our hearts. But another aspect, in when I'm speaking of those things about the emotional well-being, I'm primarily addressing the issue of depression, which is just prevalent throughout our society, cross cultures, cross gender, cross ethnicity. It's something that's very rampant in our society. However, many people do not give it its proper place in terms of how we should approach and move with that. The other part is that there are serious organic things that happen sometimes in the brain that causes an off balance that brings us that aspect of actual mental illness. And sometimes people confuse our emotional well-being with our mental well-being. And as a therapist, I would say that the majority of people that I work with really don't have a mental health issue. They have maybe mental flooding, mental clutter, but it's mostly an emotional issue in terms of not being able to sort out the many overwhelming emotions they may experience from the things that they're dealing with, the people that they're dealing with, the circumstances that they're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. But if you stay in a state of emotional upset too long, it can really physically and organically start to affect the organic compensation of our brain. So I really want us to be able to honor that, recognize it, and not to be afraid, because I think the stigma that is placed so much on issues of mental illness are ones of fear, and we all tend to label, stereotype, stigmatize, and be fearful and standoffish about the things we don't understand. So if you know or have a family member, a loved one who has a mental illness, it's important that you get educated to learn how the disease or the illness takes root and how it affects. And then also get some mental health counseling and support for yourself, because it can be very draining anytime you're dealing with someone in a situation that you don't understand. So not only is education important, humor is important as well. You know, people talk about, you know, laughter is the best medicine, and I am a true believer of that. Next to prayer, we pray and we laugh. And I am so pleased this evening to have our guest who covers many aspects of the topics that I have spoken to. I met him probably, maybe about 7 or 8 months ago through Facebook, and he commented on a post that I made, and then I started to follow his post and found out some things about him that really endeared him to my heart, and we have not met face-to-face, but I know that is going to happen. Our guest is, for one, a former foster youth himself. He transitioned out of the foster care system at the age of 18. He has a whole, just a lifetime of experiences before, during, and after foster care, which I'm sure he will share more with you about. And he also has a mother, we're talking about Mother's Day, and a family member who has a mental illness, and he'll share with you about that. But the neat part about our guest is that he's learned how to use humor to, one, help him to not only survive but thrive and the world of just challenges that have been brought to him. And not only has he learned to strive and thrive in it, he's making a living out of it. He's multi-talented. He's a writer. He's an author. He's a music publisher, a music producer. He's a playwright, and he is a screenwriter. And we're going to talk about his most recent venture, which is a movie entitled Annie Was a Liar. Ladies and gentlemen, I welcome, introduce to you, and I welcome our guest, the real Amaru. Are you there, Amaru?
Am I supposed to say something right now? We live, we on.
We're live.
There?
Welcome.
I was looking around like, who is she talking about? Who is she?
To talk about that little man I see on the screen. That makes me laugh but he'd be telling the truth anyhow.
I ain't gonna lie to you, man. My girlfriend just woke me up. I was like, she was like, you got some kind of interview to do? I said, oh no. It's hot. That heat blessed me with a little nap.
You should be really, really on top of it now. You've had a chance to rest your brain, so I know you're gonna throw it at us.
I was supposed to do 1 hour, but I decided to take two. Unbeknownst to me, I decided to take two, apparently.
Okay, well, hey, keeping it real, and to keep it more real, I've actually sent you a text. I looked on Facebook. I said, he hasn't been here for a few hours. I hope he's not asleep.
You took Facebook like, he ain't around. What's going on?
I'm glad that you're here. Thank you so much for being here. And so you heard some of my introduction that I actually started before you even came on, but I was talking about this month being recognizing Mother's Day, National Foster Care Month, as well as National Mental Health Month. And we're going to talk about your current project, but I know you have a lot of experience with all three of the topics that we're honoring this month, so you're our one-stop shop for the month.
All right, like I won the lottery or something. That's crazy.
First of all, tell us a little bit about your childhood before you went into foster care and what prompted your going into care.
My mother and father, I guess not the typical parents. They both from Gary, and somehow they met. I don't know what that story is, but it's a PG show, so I can't get into that. My father was a real-life pimp, and my mama is a Jehovah's Witness, a schizophrenic Jehovah's Witness. That means she'll knock on your door and answer it. They got together, and then they had me, and that must be when the anger kicked in, because it was nonstop from there. The volatility from there was just, something to remember even as a minor child, as early as 1, 2, 3 years old. So I have a lot of vivid memories from that time, especially when we were in Gary, and I was really, really young. So, a lot of things were very traumatic. And I just remember stuff, just like I don't forget faces. I see somebody be like, man, thought I know you from somewhere. You're like, I don't know. Be like, man, weren't you in the nursery when we was born? You were crying all the time. I remember you. I remember you. But I remember a lot of things. And my father was very volatile. He was very violent and volatile. And his abuse to my mama will reflect and double, especially when he was out of the home. I guess you'd rather have him in the home, beating on us to have him than not to have him at all. And so when he would not be in the home, in retrospect, I could see that she was affected by that and angered by that. And sometimes when a parent is gone or the other parent is angry at a parent and you look like that parent, that absent parent, or the parent that they're angry at, you receive the butt of that anger sometimes, and as a kid, we don't know that. We don't know that we look like daddy. They're like, why she keep getting at me? I ain't do nothing. You
That's
know, I
right.
just got hit. You know, but it's because you look like daddy, and that's, you know, that's unfortunate. And so it was just, and my mom was a Jehovah's, she was a devout Jehovah's Witness. I mean, she was, you know, I'm surprised she didn't get it tattooed on her somewhere. You know, she was just, she was, that or the highway. And so with that, she was suppressed a lot of my talents as a kid. At one point, I was, you know, I was the fastest kid in school. I used to go to Arcadia, and I was the fastest kid in first, second, third grade. But I wasn't able to exercise it outside of, if it didn't happen, my mama's rule, if it didn't happen during school hours, you couldn't do it. So
wow.
So I was, you know, there was no extracurricular, anything. And I could draw real well, which I don't do right now, but, you know, I could still draw if I wanted to. But I used to. That was my thing when I was a kid, and I wanted to be an artist, yada, yada, yada. And, you know, she used to throw my pictures away and say, you know, you shouldn't be drawing, you know. And I said, you shouldn't be drawing for Jesus, you know. Drawing the stuff that I was drawing wasn't holy enough for her. She'd take my comic books, throw them away, and throw my pictures away. And so I felt like I felt a little suppressed, and then I could feel that when I would, do something that would warrant trouble or getting in trouble, she went a little overboard with it. And so, you know, I took it upon myself. I ran away one time, and it was just to see, you know, how I was. And real quick, I ran away the first time. How did it go? What did I do? I just didn't go to school and was wandering the streets of Arizona. And then I didn't have a plan for the nighttime. I didn't think that far ahead. I just thought I'd run away and everything was just going to be okay. And so I did it. And then here comes nighttime. I'm like, oh, my God, I didn't think about this part. And I'm going to have to go home eventually. And, oh, no, my mama's going to murder me if I go home. I didn't think this far. Oh, my God. And so I spent some time in an arcade. So I was sitting in the booth. And I remember it was like Spy Hunter playing, you know, that's forever embedded in my mind because I fell asleep in that little booth, and then they closed. So they woke me up, you know, when I was sleeping in the Spy Hunter booth in the corner. It was like, young man, you need to get up out of here, you know, we're closing. And then that was D-Day right there. It was like, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning. It was, you know, I had nowhere else to go. And I was like, oh my God, I didn't think this far. So I was like, I got to devise a plan. I got to go back. Okay. So I go back to the house.
Did he even try to find out where you belonged?
No. He didn't care. He wanted me to get up out of his, he knew I didn't belong in his game. That's all he knew. I didn't belong in his game. So, you know, he scooted me up out of there. But I lived right down the street. So I go back home, and I sit in front of the door. And I was too scared to. So really, I was like, okay, I'm going to knock on the door, and then she's going to open the door, and I'm going to fall into the apartment, like, oh, you know. So I knocked on the door, but I didn't knock hard enough for my mama to see it, you know. I knocked, you know, so lightly that, you know, I couldn't even feel it. That's how light I knocked, but I bet my mama heard it. She heard it. I knocked like 3-4 times, and my mama heard that, opened the door, and I fell into the door. Bam. She was like, boy, where you been? You know, I played like I was just drowsy. It was like, oh, no. You know, somebody grabbed me. Blah, blah, blah. You know, I think I was in the fifth grade. And she was like, get in the bathtub, you know, clean me up, call the police. They came. I took them all around town, pointing at places. They was like, you know, and then they took me home, and then, you know, they did that adult speak that, you know, made me think everything was going to be cool, that they checked everything out, and, you know, if you hear anything, give us a call. I heard that type of stuff, and I thought everything was cool. And then she was like, okay, officer, thank you. If I figure out anything else, I can get a call. And I'm like, in my mind as a kid, I'm like, whoo, it's over. She shut that door and was like, all right, get in the room, take your clothes off, you mind? So, like, well, what happened to the police? You know, you said you was going, if anything, you sounded like you cared. she beat the brakes off me, boy. And then I think my father came home that day, and it was just double jeopardy. So that was my first time. She knew I was lying. She knew I was lying because I had, you know, took the police on a wild goose chase. And so the police told her, you know, in adult speak that this dude is lying. You know, you might want to get the belt, you know. And so that was my first time. And so after that, it became easy. I just ran away again and ran away again and ran away again. 39 times later, they finally put me in a foster home after 39 times.
Wait, oh, the 39th time, my goodness. Did you ever make plans for the night, though?
Yeah, I did. I got good. So the third time, you know, I used to pack before I went. I had my blanket and everything. And I used to sleep in the alley. You know, it's Arizona, so you really didn't need the blanket. The blanket was just for aesthetics. But, you know, I used to go sleep in the alley. And I'm talking about, I'm in the fifth and sixth grade, you know, sleeping in the alley. And I go to the mall across the street, and I survive. I will survive. You know, I must have seen Police Academy 1 like 38 times for free. One time I convinced my little brother to run with me, and I had told him that we was going to the laundromat. We was going to do laundry. Now, we ain't never did laundry by ourselves in our life, and all of a sudden we wanted to do laundry. We were latchkey kids, so my mom was at work. And especially during the summer, so we was at home by ourselves all the time. So, you know, I had convinced him. And by nighttime, he was like, we ain't been to the laundromat yet. when we going home? And so as we were sleeping in the alley, I'm explaining to him, well, we not going home, actually, you know. And he, you know, started crying. I felt all bad. You know, I was like, I'll take you back home in the morning. I'll take you back home. We went back home to Rio for supplies. And when it was time to go, when it was time to leave again, he was like, nope, I'm not leaving. I said, man, you don't get a whooping. If you know, mom won't come home, she's going to whoop you. He was like, I'm going to take a whooping. I was like, oh, man, you a punk. And I walked out the door by myself. And so, you know, after I got caught that time, I came home, and I had asked him what happened when he came home. And he was like, man, I should have went with you. I was like, why? He said, Daddy came home that day, so I got double jeopardy. I told you. You should have came.
Now, did you get in trouble each time that you came back from having run away?
At some point, my mom was like, you know what? You need to, at some point, you know, you need to go and stay gone. You know, she got tired of me doing that. You know, in retrospect, I put a lot on her, you know. And sometimes it can show. You know, I remember being at Disneyland. She had took us to Disneyland when we was kids with her best friend and scraped up some money and everything, and we went. And I ain't gotten lost. And I didn't panic. I just, you know, I was used to running away, so I was, you know, I got lost and went and seen them, rode all the rides and, you know, and did whatever we were going to do if I was with them. And then about 4 or 5 hours later, I saw them. They was walking towards the exit. I was like, hey, here I am. I swear my mama turned around and looked at me like, like,
he got away.
Like he found us. like I was looking at him like, you don't look too happy to find me, you know. And you know, I put pressure on my mama, and like I told you yesterday, as we got older, and she, you know, started dealing with the mental illness thing. I was in my early 30s, and it was time for me. I felt when me and my mother got, you know, when our relationship started to mend. This is after I was in the fall. I'm skipping ahead. I'm skipping ahead. Let me stop because it spoiled some stuff. But, yeah, that's how I started, you know,
get to that, cause I was
my
gonna,
career
well,
running away.
But actually, you're talking about the running away, and I talk about that in my book about my young foster son. But I interviewed Les Brown, and he told the story. No, he was supposed to be interviewing me, but he told the story that had us rolling about he was running away. And so his mother was sitting on the porch with her friends, and he kept going around the block. And they said, Mimi, what's wrong with that boy? She said, the fool ran away, and he got sense enough not to go more than around the block.
I got one like that. I ran.
He wanted to come in and get some water. Oh, you run away.
That sounds like my mama. I ran away from at a foster home one time. I was in a foster home, and the foster home, the place that I ran was like, it was a good 12, 15 miles away from the foster home. So, again, I didn't refer back to my experience of running away. It had been a while, and I'm like, you know, I got this. I ran away. And then what happened was it didn't work out because I didn't plan. It was wintertime, and I didn't wear a coat. And so by the time I had walked to the next town, which was 15 miles away, I was so cold, I called the police on myself. I picked up the phone. I said, hello. And they was like, yeah, 911. I said, I ran away from home. I said, oh, yeah. They said, where you at? I said, trace the call. and they traced the call and found me. They found me frozen in the phone booth and picked me up just like that and laid me in the car and drove me back to the foster home. And that's how even my foster mother was. We lived in the country, and so we burned firewood for heat. And so this is how evil she was. She had heard I was coming back. The police had me and everything. And so all the foster kids, she rounded up all the foster kids and her husband and everybody. And so when I walked through the door, the fireplace was blazing. It was blazing. And she was sitting in her little chair that she's sitting in the corner was rocking, and everybody was sitting around the fireplace. And I came in there shivering, and she looked at me and was like, welcome home. You cold? I was like, yeah. And I went over there and sat right next to her, next to the fireplace, to get warm.
Wow.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We're talking about, you know, just the humor in it and the adventure, because I'm sure, you know, I can just imagine you doing the Disneyland thing all by yourself, because once kids learn to be with themselves, they can entertain themselves. And people are trying to, you know, assimilate them in with the mainstream and say, you know, let's do this, let's do that. And you've developed your own safe haven there. That's important.
Yeah, I was walking around there, I was saying, I was walking around there, and, I felt comfortable. I really wasn't too worried. I figured, it was before noon. We were going to be here all day, and eventually I'll find them. That was my thought process as a minor kid, and so I didn't waste that time being there. I'm like, shoot, we poor. We might not ever see this again except on TV. Let me enjoy some of this. And so, I did everything that I was able to get into. That was going on the rise, going on whatever, and may do, you know.
So at this point, you mentioned that, I guess, you lived in Gary, Indiana?
I lived in Gary from the time I was born until I started kindergarten, I think.
Okay.
And at one point, my aunt and uncle wanted to keep me. At this point, I was still the only child. And so, I was spoiled. And so as an adult now, it's just me, my little brother, and my female cousin. That's it for the whole family on the side of my father's family. That's the only kids that are us. And so at that point, I'm the oldest grandkid, so I was the only one at the time. And so my aunts and uncles wanted to keep me because they knew their brother. They knew their brother was violent. They knew their brother wasn't going to do right by us. They knew all this. And so they got into it with him because they really wanted to keep me. And my mama, for that matter, they didn't like him. You know, my grandmother made my father leave Gary by gunpoint. They were very prominent people. Yeah, they were very prominent people in Gary. And the fact that my father has, or my grandfather still has a church in his name standing in Gary. And so I was finding this stuff out as an adult. My uncle was telling me about my father, and every time he would finish the story, he referenced and say, boy, your father was crazy, man. He was crazy. And then he told me another story about him being crazy. And this would give you an outlook on what type of person my father was. He didn't care who it was. He would do them dirty. One time he had taken us to Gary, and just me and my mother and him, and he dropped us off over his mama's house, and while he'd go around the streets and do whatever. So, my uncle was like, yeah, he'd go, your father make a vacation coming to Gary, going to fight the police and, get drunk or whatever, do whatever he do. And this time he went and fought the police. You know, he was like, he kicked their tail, and then they called in for backup and kicked his tail, took him to jail. And he had just started this job at GM. I remember the job he had at General Motors here in Michigan. And he had called my mama, my grandmother, and begged and pleaded with her to, you know, bail him out of jail. She was like, well, I really don't have the money, Martin, but, you know, I got the rent money. But I need my money, Martin. You know, I give it to you. I swear I give it to you. Just bail me out. I can't lose the job. You know, I just had your grandbaby. He used me. You know, I just had your grandbaby and, you know, I'm trying to do right, blah, blah, blah. She was like, all right, but I need my money, Martin. I give it to you. I got you. So she bailed him out, gave the money by bailing him out. Week passed. She called him for the money in Michigan. He picked up the phone. He was like, you know, I need my money, Martin. I need it for rent. He was like, you shouldn't have gave it to me. And I'm like, great.
Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yep. Talk about heartless. Now, we talk about the fact that your mother had a mental illness. Do you suppose your dad might have had mental illness as well?
No. Well, okay. I think, well, in retrospect, I found out, from picking up on some of the stuff he did, and then what my uncle was telling me. My uncle said that my father was born with a hole in his head, and the doctors and my grandmother, they didn't know what it was from. It healed, but he was born with a hole nevertheless. So whatever that hole was, it was that crazy that was in him. My uncle was like, he was carrying a gun at school when he was in seventh grade. So back in them days in the 60s, you know, for him to be carrying a gun in seventh grade, and Gary, you know, he was straight crazy and gangster like, and they were friends with the Jacksons. You know, all my relatives went to school with the Jacksons. My uncle was best friends with Mike from kindergarten to the fifth grade, and so getting around. You know, I don't know if my daddy was taking notes from Joe Jackson or what the case was, but that he got that message.
He was getting private tutoring.
Yeah, prior to driving tutor. Now, when you whoop them, make sure you got the belt like this, you know. Taking notes. And, you know, it was just something was wrong with my father. And whatever it was, my brother inherited it because he passes it on to his kids. All of his kids, even from different mothers, have something wrong with their spinal cord and their head. So whatever my father had, my little brother inherited it, and we didn't even know anything about it until we became adults in regards to him having something wrong, or my father having something wrong with him, you know.
See, that's one of the things that, on a serious note, that within our culture and our society, and especially within the African American community, when we have someone who is, you know, quote unquote different, and then we outright relabel them as crazy. Sometimes there is an organic source to it, but because we shy away from the mental health services and just the whole field of psychology and psychiatry, we don't get the services that we need. And even people now who get them, usually what they just get is, you know, some medication. And I think there's so many ways to approach it, but it creates a real drift, a big chasm in ability to communicate, and it breeds even more unhealthiness. So what do you think it has helped you to be on the almost other side?
people ask that, and I ask myself that question sometimes, especially when I achieve certain things. And my go-to statement has always been, and I can remember this even as a kid, I always wanted to be somebody. And I knew what that meant. I always wanted to be somebody. So even when I was doing dirt as a kid or getting in trouble, even when I was in my foster homes, I really never got in trouble. I never got in trouble in regards to the police or anything like that. But before I got involved in the foster homes, getting in trouble and doing certain things, you know, to, I guess, get attention that something was happening in the home, get me away from this or whatever. But I always wanted to be somebody, so it kept me from doing, you know, something that was going to catch a felony or something that was going to be, you know, really detrimental to my well-being as a productive citizen And I just always wanted to be somebody. I always wanted to, you know, I wanted to be an artist, and then it turned into being an actor or entertainer of some sort. Never thought about a stand-up. Just, you know, I was always a class clown, but stand-up never even into my vocabulary. It was just I wanted to be on TV and an entertainer.
And, you know, I think that's the core of it right there. As we say, I often say, you know, we have to give our children a something to hold on to. If they have nothing to look forward to, help them to develop a vision. So you had a vision, because the scripture says, you know, without a vision, they perish. So you had a vision. It wasn't a clear vision, but you had one, and you held on to that, and you're still holding on to it. Like I told you, you know, just from afar, I could just see your work ethic, you know, your, as you would say, your grind, your hustle. It's really hard because you believe in what you're doing and where you're going. Now, ironically, the way that we connected was I was interviewing Mike Pritchard, who is a child
Michael
advocate.
Michael Pritchard, yeah.
Yeah, a comedian.
That name,
and you come
post
and said that he was really one of the people that sort of inspired you that you could actually get paid doing this. Tell us about what you recall about hearing Mike Pritchard, who I just love him to pieces. What do you...
I remember as a kid when I finally got into the system in regards to foster home. I think I was in between foster home. Excuse me. And they used to have these programs in the juvenile home where, you know, people come talk to us and, you know, ex-prisoners, this and the third. And this time it was Michael Pritchard's turn, and, you know, some big white guy coming in and talking to us, you know, a bunch of black kids, you know, whatever. And so I'm sitting there watching this dude, and he gets to talking and making these funny voices and entertaining us by laughter and told us what he did. Now he had us, our attention, because we started laughing, and, you know, it wasn't somebody there to talk down to us necessarily like the others when they're telling us the truth, you know, the unrestricted truth. And, you know, Michael had a different angle, and it was cool. And it was an entertainment, and so I was intrigued. And so I know for a fact had somebody like Michael, more people like him or myself would came along as a kid that was in that industry, I would have changed my life in regards right there, right then and there. And I would attach myself to them and try to get all the information I could or, you know, and go in that direction. But after he left, that was it. You know, I didn't meet anybody else like him until, you know, I moved back, you know, to Arizona as an adult, you know. But I always remembered him. He always left an impression in my mind. And so when I was on the internet and I saw his name, I'm like, Michael Pritchard, I know that. And I clicked on his picture. I said, that's that dude, you know. That's him. That's him, you know.
I didn't think I was ever going to see him again. Yeah, I told him about you that you had commented on it, and he's met so many people. It turns out there are other people that I know who know him they didn't know. But I used to actually watch him on television, and I would videotape his programs and then play them on the VHS at the school for the group I did with kids. I just loved him. And so I happened to be doing a workshop at UC Davis, and he was the keynote speaker. And so I went, and after I said, let me just go up here and talk to him. I went up. We've been friends ever since, been laughing ever since, and he's just a great source, and he's sincere. So I hope to be able to help you with meeting him and the two of you sharing a stage for an event that we're going to do on behalf of
him. Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be great. He really had an influence, and he don't even know it. I don't even think I really talked to him after the thing was over. I think some other people may have, but you know, I walked away with a piece of him. So you know,
good.
He should be awesome. Be proud.
And so see, that piece has reconnected you. See what happened?
Mm-hmm.
That little piece of him and you connected with that little piece of him and me, and here we are. Indeed.
Yeah,
I wanted to talk about two other things before we start to talk about the movie. And believe it or not, we have 20 minutes left, but I always give us a little extra time. So for anyone who has to go at 6, oh well. But talking about people, you know, him being someone who influenced you, and I always try to emphasize to anyone who's listening to any of the messages that I give, any of the platforms that I bring former foster youth on to speak, the importance of being a mentor or just interacting and being some source of connection, the giving hope and giving validation to our young people. Were there other people along the way who had a positive impact in your life?
Yeah, when I started writing movies, another important person, two important people. Matter of fact, I just reconnected with one yesterday, and I don't know, it seemed like he upset with me, and the way we departed, or that it wasn't on any negative terms. So, you know, he was going, you know, I was going through some stuff, he was going through some stuff, and we parted ways, but he had an influence, and I didn't know that last night, and he was like, oh, okay, you know. But the first person, when I had gotten a movie deal off the first screenplay that I had written, and I had lived in California and then came back to Michigan. Well, while I was in California, I had gotten introduced to a guy named Fred Johnson, who was an executive, who was a writer on the show 227, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and a bunch of other shows. And then he was the executive producer of The Parkers and Moesha at the time.
Okay.
And so I had went on, I had met him. And past, you know, I used to watch Moesha a lot, the TV show Moesha, and I watched it so much, I wrote a spec script for it, just inside and out, and I wrote a script for it. And I ended up meeting the guy that ran the show, Fred, so I passed it on to him, and so I ended up having to go back to Michigan to regroup or whatever, and I got a call from the executive producer of Moesha out of the blue. I didn't expect it, but he called me, and one of his words that he said to me was, because at this point, I'm a writer. I haven't been really validated yet. I kind of been validated, but what I needed was some validation by somebody that worked in that industry that appreciated my writing. That's what I needed. I didn't know I needed it, but that's what I needed. And so he called me and gave it to me, and one of his words was, he said, as a black man, I'm calling you to let you know and validate you because I know how important that is. And I know right now that you're probably searching in your mind whether you should keep going or not. He's like, well, call him and let you know that you're not an imposter. He said,
ooh.
I read the script. Yeah. Mm. He said, I read the script, and he said, I could tell that you know these characters inside and out, bro. He was like, wow. He said, the unfortunate part is that it's the last season of Moesha. He said, had it not been for that, I would be calling you, offering you a job as a staff writer. He said, but
wow.
If you are in L.A. again, he said, if you're in California again, come out and see me and see where we're at and whatever. Man, I must have hung up the phone and beamed myself there because I was there. I was there within the year and showed up on set, was like, hey, they called him. And I was like, what's up, man? He's like, hey, man, how you doing? He kept his word. There was nothing really available as being a writer for Moesha, but the Parkers was on the same lot. They weren't being canceled, but there still wasn't a writing position open. I was like, hey, well, can I get on the show? You know, can I get in front of the camera or something? You know, my theory was all they could say is no. And and he looked at me and he was like, well, follow me. And he walked me right into casting and was like, put him on. And it was just that simple.
Wow.
And so, you know, I did an episode of that, got that experience. You know, I used to work for Master P, but had it not been for that call and the words he said to me and the little education he gave me, I don't know if I would have continued. And then I met another brother named Jimmy Dright, a.k.a. Chopmaster. I met him while I was staying in Studio City. He was one of the founders of Digital Underground who discovered Tupac. And so he used to come over to his friend's house who helped them get the deal when they were Digital Underground with Tommy Boy Records. And so he used to come over there, and they were friends or whatever, and they were going to do a project, and he'd see me over there. I'm sleeping on the couch, you know, and I'm this young, struggling writer trying to get on in the business. And he took to me. He used to pick me up and take me on, you know, take me to the store and give me a couple of dollars and be like, hey, man, you know. And he's like, I know Daryl, you know, I know my man ain't really, you know, blah, blah, blah. He just, you know, blah, this, that, and the third, and this is a little something. You won't make it. Don't worry about it, you know, blah, 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 blah. And one day he hired me to write a movie based on a book he wrote about Tupac. He and a few other people had legal rights to write. He had just won a lawsuit. So him and a few other people had the legal right to make a movie about, an authorized movie about Tupac. And I was the first one, I think I was the first one in the country to be commissioned to write a Tupac film. And so he commissioned me. He gave me the materials. He gave me some money down to write, to start writing. I was excited. This was before Eminem's movie. This was before Tupac Resurrection, all that. And so this could change my life. You know, I met the guy. He hooked me up, and this was, and then, you know, his love was music. His first love was music. And I had found out that he had messed around and gotten, like, two record deal offers while this was going on. And he was like, forget that movie, and did that, you know, went ahead and did the movie and, or excuse me, the music, and, you know, dropped the project, and it never happened. But he had that faith in me, and based on the scripts that I had already written, and the reason I was there staying at his boy's house in the first place was to write something for him in exchange to introducing me to people in the industry and this, that, and the third. But I had to tell him, you know, yesterday that, you know, the stories you would tell us and the laughter you would give me, it was a glimpse of hope. You know, you inspired me, and the stories you told me about Tupac and your life and how the business was and what the business is about and blah, blah, blah. That really helped me. And I would never forget him for that. I would never forget him for that and that experience. So I wanted him to know that. And I got to tell him that yesterday, whether he acknowledged that he married me and he said, oh, thank you, whatever. But I still haven't talked to him on the phone yet, and I'm waiting for that conversation, and I hope it happens. But, yeah, there were some people that were from the business and in the business that validated me. And so to this day, you know, I'm eight movies in, eight scripts in, three sitcoms. I got, you know, four books that I wrote coming out this year. And I'm gonna make it happen. You know, I'm tired of waiting for people who have the power to say yes in my destiny. And it took me 16 years to realize that. And so on this, you know, this part of my journey, you know, I got a lot of the equipment to do it already. You know, I did the movie Annie Was a Liar, and it's just been on a roll from there. In regards to taking my career, my destiny in my own hands and no longer waiting for someone to say yes. I'm saying yes to myself and making these things happen. I was always the guy with the ideas and the talent, but I was never the guy with the money. I was never that guy with the money to make it happen, you know, to really, you know, make it happen the way I wanted to happen. You know, so
you sound like
so
me.
Now
I have champagne taste on a root beer budget.
Right. I didn't even have a root beer budget. It was just root. That's all I had. I could get the root. I get the beer 2 weeks later and remember what the root tastes like, put that together in my mind, and I got it.
But one day, I'm going to be at one of your premieres. I'm going to be sitting in the front seat with my mimosa in my hand saying,
there you go, there you go. Like, right there. That's what champagne tastes like, darling. That's what it tastes like at the same time. That's what it tastes like.
I love it. And I believe it too, because I see you from a distance, and even just when I first met you, and like I said to you when we spoke, that I immediately wanted to get on the wagon and to do some things and bring you out here and have you to hook up with my boy Dion. And then it's like, okay, reality hit. How you gonna pay for this?
right.
One day, and I believe that when we have a gift and we have a vision, it all comes together. It's just a matter of timing. So I definitely
Everybody has a gift. A lot of us just refuse to open it.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I love that. Indeed. So since we're talking about your writing, I wanted to talk more a little bit about your mom, but let's go right into talking about Annie Was a Liar.
Well, Annie, the reason why I write, and I've been writing since first grade, and I remember I used to write stories in my class. We were assigned to write creative writing assignments or whatever. My class would always have me go last because mine was the funniest. It didn't make any sense, but it was always hilarious. And so I attribute my writing, my creative vision and writing came from, you know, so when the abuse was happening, especially with my father, I would retreat into my mind, into another land. You know, I was Superman, somebody Spider-Man, somebody superhero, saving the day somehow. And I'm revealing it to my friends that I'm a superhero in the middle of church service. You know, I was gone, man. I was somewhere else. And that was just me. And so, like I said, I had a vivid memory. I have vivid memories from my childhood. And so inadvertently, my parents and my life, they prepared me and gave me all these stories, these things to write about. And my pain in class was shielded through laughter anyway. And, you know, I used to get bullied at some point in my school career, and I would have to laugh some of it off sometimes, and even though I was hurting. And so as I figured out when I got older that a lot of people feel these feelings, these emotions, and so I started sending those feelings and emotions and learned how to manipulate them in regards to writing. And saw people, I would watch people's faces when I would write something and watch them, you know, they drop a tear or they cry, they would laugh when they were supposed to laugh, or that was intriguing to me, like, wow. And so, I when I met my friend in Florida, he was doing a video project or something. I was like, I got a script yet? I want to be a part of it. You know, he was like, no, we don't have a story yet, but we just going to shoot something. I was like, well, I'll have a story tomorrow. And I wrote my first script.
Wow.
And, I have taken stories within my life and put them into movie situations and books and stories or whatever. And so a lot of the books and movies that I've written is a piece of me in some form or fashion. And so, you know, I've written 8 scripts and I'm turning them all into books as well. And I've done 4 of them already and I'm working on my 5th one now. And so I have enough work to keep me busy for the next 20 years. And so I started that journey with Danny Was a Liar, which, you know, I was always told to talk about something first. I wanted to put something out before I really did a feature film just to get that experience and see if I could pull it off. And so I pulled off Danny Was a Liar, and now I'm working on a television show called USE, The Ultimate Social Experiment. It's a sci-fi web series. And I got a, you know,
I didn't know what that was.
Chicago. Oh yeah. I got a business partner in Chicago who's very excited about it, and he believes in me. He's seen my work ethic, you know, he always called me the hardest working man in show business, and I'm always, you know, I put some stuff together, showed it to him. And how I got the idea for the show is I was driving and dropping my kids off to their mama, and I was thinking, like, how much I disliked her, and if I could change her, she's just missing a certain gene. what if I could change people's genes? And I started thinking about it, and all of a sudden, this show became what it is. And so, this show spawned for me my dislike of my ex-wife. So one day I'm going to thank her. She doesn't know why.
Grenade out of liver.
Right. One day I'm going to say thank you. Why he thanking me? You have no idea.
Stop, Annie. Tell us. I think we all can get the premise behind the name. So tell us just how that thought came and what, for people who purchased the CD the DVD, can look forward to.
Well, Annie Was a Liar. Annie Was a Liar is just that. When I first went into foster care, I was running away thinking that, I'll be put in a foster home, and it'll be like Annie. The only thing that I had as a blueprint of what foster care would be like was the movie Annie. And I realized when I went to my first foster home that little redhead son of a gun lied to me. She lied to me. I wanted to, anybody red here, I wanted to drown them, do something to them, because this ain't real. She got a big house, a mansion, I got a farm.
Okay.
And pigs, and goats, just don't look, you know. I had a bald head man who said he was my, you know, my foster father, but that way he wasn't Daddy Warbucks, you know.
Okay.
Daddy Warbucks is tall and bald. This dude was short and stubby and bald. You know, he's a farmer. Daddy Warbucks is a boss, and this don't match up. So my point was is that even when you get a job at McDonald's, they give you a video on how to work the fryer. You know, they just threw us in that situation. You know, here you go, this is your new home, and deal with it. There was no training, there was no manual, there was no, you know. One of the people in the film says to me, she says, we go to a foster home, you know, they have all kind of information about us, but we ain't got nothing about them. We don't know nothing about them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the movie is to help people who are thinking about or are considering going into that field in regards to adoption or being a foster parent, to give them some insight on what we thought when we went to a foster home. And I think it's effective because somebody called me and let me know that they decided to adopt based on that movie. And they were on the fence about whether they wanted to do it or not. And that film gave them some insight on what a child is going through when they enter a foster home. When it's the fear of the unknown, you know, we have the fear of the unknown because we, again, don't know what it's going to be like. And so all the parent is thinking is, oh, they're so scared and I'm going to make them comfortable and blah, 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 blah. But that's not just it, you know. We need you to understand that this is new to us in every aspect. You know, if I moved with my mama, wherever we moved at, the smells were the same, the cooking was the same, and so you have that familiarity and that nostalgia. When you go to a foster home, the food isn't the same, the smell of the household isn't the same, the friends at school are new, and the whole scenario. And so it's a scary, scary world for a child. And so that's what this movie's purpose is. You know, and to debunk some of the things in regards to these commercials we see depicting that children and, you know, you can adopt these children and they have no problems, no issues. First and foremost, if you're in a foster home, you got some kind of issue, you know.
Even if it's just grieving, loss.
Right. Something's wrong with you. You're in a foster home, so, you know, something's wrong with you. You know, and some
I'm not wrong with you. Something is wrong with where you've been that affects you, because we don't want to get it because it's wrong with the kid.
Right.
Something's wrong in the kid's life.
Right, exactly. And sometimes there's going to be something wrong with the kid. Right. Sometimes there's something wrong with the kid, and these parents don't realize that, and they want to take them back like they bought them from the store, and you can't do that. So you need to be prepared for the worst. You know, you might get told one thing, and it might be another thing. You need to be prepared for that as well, and so that's what this movie is about.
Wow, and I was hoping to actually have my copy to have viewed it. And I was thinking, oh, gosh, we could do a viewing for Foster Care Month. So that means I've got 11 days to get it and set something up. Maybe I could do something on the 31st, but I would really like to do that. And when you're talking about preparing, the workbook that I've created to go along with my memoir is How's Your Heart Working in the Village? It's really a self-introspection for potential and current caregivers to really look so much as focusing on the kid, focusing on yourself. What triggers your feelings and what you like, what you don't like. Because sometimes we're not clear until something has happened that tees us off, and then we're gone, and the kids are looking at like, what is your problem? And it's just as much of the adult's problem as it is the child. So I really like that concept. So is it interviews? Is it, what is it consist of? How different?
It consists of interviews. There's one interview from an organization out in San Francisco that is called From a Home Within, and it was a resource that I stumbled upon in doing research for the film, a free resource for foster kids, even when they age out. that I never knew anything about and a lot of people don't know about. You know, a lot of people, you know, we belong to these forums of foster kids and they're asking about, you know, therapy. You know, I need therapy. Where can I go? I can't really afford it. I don't have insurance. Well, this particular resource is free. And they have 55 chapters throughout the country. You know, always looking and they're always recruiting for new therapists, but the service is free. Even if you have, even if you're not in the system, if you aged out of the system, it's free for foster kids and former foster kids. And that's a very valuable resource that a lot of us that have been in foster care need, that haven't been to therapy and are scared to go to therapy because of the stigma, the stigmatism that comes along with it, especially, as you said, black folks, you know, we think it's uncool to go see a doctor. You must be crazy then. Well, maybe I am, but I need to go talk to somebody and figure out these thoughts and emotions and put a name to them and so that I can better understand them myself. If I don't understand them, then I can't deal with them. I couldn't possibly deal with them. So I learned that a long time ago, you know. And so she, I interview her, and she gives us great insight in the resource and where people can go and how to support them and where to go for your therapeutic sessions and this, that, and the third. And then there's testimony from another organization here in Michigan that helps girls who've gotten themselves pregnant or runaways, this, that, and the third, called Angel House. And we
You know, I've got this thing. You said girls who got themselves pregnant.
It's a choice. It's a choice. That I'm not saying that to disregard them. They got themselves pregnant because of you know, the lack of education about sex, or because in the end they are responsible because the guys can walk away, and that's why I said it that way. And so the education or the miseducation of a person, one sexuality, or with contraception and that education and miseducation of that, because one of the questions that I ask the person that that works at Angel House is, why should we care? They're in this situation. Why should we care? And she said that we have to care. You know, if you don't take care of them, because these kids, aka young ladies, who mothers are bringing up, especially male children. You know, they are bringing up the male children.
3-4-7-4-9-8-0
Sorry about that.
Hello?
Hi, this is Miss T. A few months back, I celebrated my birthday. I invited callers to celebrate with me.
You sound like a commercial. I was like, what's going on? But they're not knocking on the doors no more. They're just cutting up the conversation.
Okay. Did you recognize that lady's voice?
Was that you?
That was me.
Oh, wow, yeah. I was like, that's you? I'm like, that sounds like hers.
hit a feature on this that I had not seen before, and it went there. Okay, now I know something new. Anyway. We apologize. Excuse her.
It's all good. The bottom line is, I asked, why should a person watching this care about your girls? And the bottom line is, we need to care about them because they are raising our children, our next generation. And and without them being educated, they are doomed to fail. And so that's why we should care and do what we can to help them get out of that situation and to bring them up to be productive citizens.
Exactly. Well, this has been wonderful, and I look forward to sharing more time, and I really look forward to, you know, interviewing you in person for our television program, but also being in your audience and just sharing, because the information and the wealth of information, the skills, the talents that you have, and your you know, your work ethic and your dream and your drive is something that our young people, not only our young people, our elders, need so very much. And I just appreciate it, and I consider it a privilege to be able to have connected with you and to be able to share the vision, because I know there's definitely a need. So tell our listeners how to contact you and how they can order the movie and the cost.
Well, they can go to they can contact me. They can go to therealamaru.com, or they can go to anniewasaliar.com and get the movie, or they can download, stream it. Just go to anniewasaliar.com, and it'll give you information on either getting the DVD or downloading it. If you get the DVD, I'll sign and I'll autograph it or whatever, and you'll have a personalized copy. I think the DVD is like $11.99 or $12.99. The download itself is $4.99. But again, if you get the DVD,
I'll admit, because I'm on this computer like at late night when my brain is at half staff.
Mm-hmm.
I heard or you said something about being able to download it, and I went to the site thinking I could do that to preview it before we had this interview. I was still going to order because I like things in my hand. I did not see that feature. So maybe I missed something.
It says if you click on streaming, live streaming, is a banner right at the bottom of it. You click on that, it'll take you to the part of the site where you can download it.
Well, we will do that soon, and we encourage all of our listeners to do so. But most of all, get it in hand and share it with others, because this is a part of the mission of educating and forming the community, the village, as well as validating our young people. Someone can benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so everyone, we can't be everywhere at one time, but we can take everywhere. Everyone can take you with us where we go.
And after the film runs its film festival circuit and this, that, and the third or whatever, I'm going to be going to those film festivals and setting up shows in regards to that area as a comic. And so, you know, on my website, all those updates will be on there when they come to pass. And, you'll see how I am in person is the dude I am on stage in regards to, you know, my attitude on telling it like it is. I'm a little more, what's the word I should use? I'm a little more, you know, I like my grandfather, you know, I'm gonna cuss. but we all have fun, and it's coming from a great place, and it's coming from a cat that's experienced true pain, and I'm showing you how you can get through that pain.
Indeed. Well, our time has passed, but I'm gonna check to see, open up the lines, and if anyone has that's interesting. The lines aren't opening up. That's cute. I'm trying to see. It's just twirling.
Nobody wants to talk to me.
Actually, I think it's my computer. Okay, it says the connection was reset. Okay. So if you're listening and you would like to share or ask a question or comment to Amaru, if you just be patient, we're getting there. I did really good. opened up. I multitask. I'm talking and I'm clicking and I'm doing things.
Well, I just want to say I appreciate you for inviting me on and allowing me to speak about the goings on of Amaru and I was listening to you before the show, and I didn't realize you were an active therapist. And were you in foster care yourself? Or
no, people ask me and it took me years to figure out why I'm so passionate about it. Besides having grown up next to a foster family that I really despised the family, but all my work ended up being with youth who had been displaced in some way or the other. Then I became a social worker, Then I became a foster mm-hmm. parent and an adoptive parent. And so when I got okay. my therapy license, actually even a former supervisor told me that I should specialize in issues related to foster care because by that time I understood more than the average person. But what it really boils down to for me is I realize the same thing, the thing that I have in common with the youth that I work with is that desire and need for family. It finally hit me, okay, that's why it's so real and so strong, and I see that. And the bottom line is we may not have the same experiences, but there's only so many emotions that that there are, and we share many of them. And I think if people can connect at that place of the heart, they will really get in touch. And that's why I'm really so, you know, passionate about working from the heart. Because if you can feel someone, you know how we often say, I feel you, I feel you. If we really felt people, we wouldn't treat them the way that we do.
Right.
That is very, very important.
Because everybody is in it for the right reasons, and that's another thing that the film points out. You know, I have four such foster parents, and my first set, I was there in that home for 2 weeks. You know, and I got removed over a haircut, and I talk about that in the film too. I got kicked out of my first foster home over a haircut, and yeah. You gotta get the movie to find out. But in my second foster home, and I liked it actually. I liked that foster home, even though it was in the country, and over a haircut. And you know, I tell the story in the film. And then one foster home I ran away from after a month because she was straight crazy. I knew she was crazy when I first got there because her and her husband didn't live in the same house. And I thought that was strange. He lived in his own house around the corner. I asked him, I said, Harvey, why y'all don't live together? Y'all married? He was like, look, young man, you just got here. Ask me that question in a week. I was like, what? And so 2 days later, I was knocking on his door. I think he was waiting for me. He was like, you're early. He said, you're early. He offered me a beer. You're early.
Oh, that is hilarious.
He said, I love her, but I kill her. You know, I was like, man, she is something else. I gave somebody a pair of clippers to take me back to the juvenile home.
And it's interesting.
Yeah.
To get foster parents to realize, is it that serious? You know, when they are having issues with the kid, is this a life, in 10 years, 5 years from now, is it going to really matter? Are we really going to displace this child because of an issue that is really not a life and death or safety issue?
Right, that was trivial. I'm sorry, let me interrupt you. She, this is how crazy she was over the haircut. So all I had was a shag. It was a simple shag, you know, Bobby Brown shag. Remember them shags in the back, the little strip of hair. That's all I had because at that point, that was the first time I had ever been able to get a haircut the way I wanted it. So they took us to the barber, and they had no instructions. And I got a simple low-cut haircut with a shag. I always wanted a shag, and I got it. And so she tripped so bad, she showed up at my school to talk to my counselor about my haircut. They called me down to the office, and I'm thinking it was over my schedule or something else I got to take home or whatever because I had just gotten out with a new student. I get to the office. They're like, yeah, your counselor wants to talk to you. I go into the counselor office, and my counselor looked right at me and just shook his head to the side. And I look and see my foster parent sitting right in there, you know, like, I'm like, what's And she's like, your haircut. When you talk about your hair, you need to get rid of that haircut. And then I was like, are you serious? You've come to my school over my hair? And, you know, at that point I was like, you know what, I'll cut it because I liked the school. I was popular. I had gotten a girl. I had a girlfriend, you know, and it was just cool, a cool situation. I had a cool foster brother. He was teaching me how to wrestle, all that. So I was like, I'll get it cut. When I get home, you can cut it off. You know, she was like, you'll cut it? I was like, yes, I'll get it cut. I don't want to argue about this anymore. It's not worth it. So I'm thinking when I get home, my hair is going to be cut. when I went home, my probation officer's car was in the driveway. And we got home, you know, I go into the house, he's standing there. I'm like, what, did I forget something? Why are you here? And then I looked to the other side, I saw my bag sitting there. And he was like, nope, you leave it. I'm like, why? And she was like, you too mouthy for me. She's sitting in her wheelchair, you too mouthy for me. You too mouthy, you got to go, you got to go. And her husband, and she was pretty dominant, and her husband was just standing there all defenseless behind her, looking at me like, well, I ain't know with you that long. I can't defend you, you know. He was like, he might get kicked out. I'm like, he didn't say nothing. But, yeah, I got kicked out over a haircut. And each time you are removed from a foster home and put into another foster home, that's another chance in case for rejection.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that's,
you know,
another rejection. It's another trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting.
Yep.
Like, I'm already thinking there's something that we could do together, because one of my signature stories has to do with a haircut, cutting my youngest foster son's hair. And it's just, that's where I got the name for my nonprofit organization. So I'll have to share my story with you so we can do something about haircuts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, not barbershop, but haircuts. Because this is in the kitchen.
I heard that. Right.
Yeah.
That's what I heard.
Well, you know.
That's why I can't.
Go ahead.
No, I was saying that's how I, in the kitchen, a lot of things happen in the kitchen. That's where I got a realization. Say it again?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. So I was in the kitchen, and I got to, this is the most important question and clarity I've ever gotten from my mama through our, you know, years of on and off relationship. And this is the most important piece of my life, I think, to date, in regards to my relationship with my mama, our estranged relationship. She was in the kitchen, and I always wanted to ask her why she married my father three times, because he was killing us.
Mm.
And so I was sitting at the table, and my mother was washing dishes, and so her back was to me. And this is like a movie, and one day it's going to be in a movie. And she, I think it's in one of my books, actually. I think it's in Breaking the Cycle, I want to say. But she, you know, it was my chance as a kid to ask my mama this important question. You know, I was sitting with my man, and then I was like, I need to ask you something. And she was like, go ahead. I said, and I explained to her, I said, why did you marry him three times? He was killing us. He was killing us. The dishes she had down in her hand. Paused for a moment. She turned around and she looked at me and she said to me simply, because I was trying to raise two men.
Mm.
And then turned back around, picked up her dishes and continued on. And
that
shut me down. That shut me down. I thought I was going to come back with, and another thing, she quieted that whole thought process. It was over. Like, that was her mentality. She was a single black mother trying to do it on her own and barely making it by. And she's got these two men to raise.
Wow. That's deep. That's a whole other book title right there. Well, you already said it's going to
mm-hmm.
be a single
well, it's called Breaking the Cycle. I already wrote it.
Oh, okay.
I already wrote it.
Well, I got to get my copy. Well, I finally got back into the studio. I've opened the line, so if any of our listeners, I'm not even going to go through the area codes, et cetera, I'll just say if any of our listeners would like to have some words or a question to Amaru, this is your time before we end our program tonight. We want to thank you for listening. Thank you for calling in, and I hope that there has been some benefit, some enlightenment, and some laughter for you in listening to this call this evening.
Most
is there anyone else?
Anybody? Nobody wants to talk to me.
Amaru.
It's all about.
Hello?
Did somebody say something?
Yeah, I did.
Is that you again?
Huh?
Is that somebody on
no,
the line?
No, me. That's not me. That's a caller.
Oh, okay.
I just
Hello?
Wanted to ask you. How long were you in foster care? I'm sorry, I missed the first part of the room.
I was in foster care from the beginning of eighth grade until my senior, until I graduated.
So that was about Well, 5 years, 4 years, 5 years?
Five and a half. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And a lot of your opinions and things have been formed at that moment about your life. So what I guess it's benefited you the fact that you come up being a comic and a writer and a movie producer. I got to produce some movies soon. Okay.
You're asking, okay. Are you asking me what did that spawn any of that or I'm not, I don't
well, it sounds like it did. I don't want to ask.
Yeah, it did. It, you know, when something would happen, I would revert to my imagination. I would, at the time, especially as a kid, I was an artist, so I drew, and
okay.
I was in my fantasy land, and that was the place that kept me safe and sane, and I was able to express. And so becoming a comic, I guess, was a natural progression because it was my therapy because I needed
mm-hmm.
therapy,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't getting it,
mm-hmm.
and so I was.
Okay.
You know, that was self-medicating in regards to being on stage because I could talk about that which bothered me and make it funny, and because I knew there were people out there that could relate to what I was talking about, whether it be a taboo subject or not. Normally, taboo subjects are things that need to be talked about, and I was able, and I am able to articulate that in a comical way, and so that you could laugh about it, and then you could deal with it later. The goal
yeah,
is to.
Yeah.
Spark that dialogue, that which was uncomfortable, then, wow, this dude made me laugh about it. I've never been able to laugh about that. Now the dialogue
right.
begins
right.
once you leave that comedy club. Now you can begin to heal and begin. In fact, I was telling Ms. Hogan that in the Florida Keys I did a gig, and I really never have talked about being in foster home and stand up. I do it every now and then, and I'm going to do it more now since the movie. But I spoke about the time that I ran away ill prepared in the wintertime without a coat. And the guy after the show, he walked up to me, he said, a lot of you guys make up stuff during your sets. I was wondering if you were really in a foster home. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. And probably about 95% of the things I say are true. And he was like, wow. He's like, I was in foster homes. And I wanted to ask you for some advice. And I was like, shoot. He said, and he began to tear up. He said, I've been in foster homes, and I have four children, and he grown children who are often and have families of their own and live their lives. But to this date, they had never known that I was in foster care. I was like, wow.
Wow.
He said, so my question to you is, should I tell them? This is when he cried. And I was like, heck yeah, you should tell them. I'm like, you're cheating them out of their rite of passage.
And in fact,
they could be going through some stuff right now that they feel isolated about, and you have the key.
Mm-hmm.
You have the answers for them. And, man, that man balled mm-hmm. and balled and balled, and he gave me a great big mm-hmm. bear hug and thanked me. He was like, I needed that. I felt guilty. He's like, I still feel guilty. He said, in fact, when we leave here from vacation, I'm going to call a family meeting and I'm going to tell them. And he,
wow.
He thanked me. And so it's moments like that make me do what I do. And I'll say one more story before we had to hang up or whatever. Another reason why I'm in entertainment, and it's all about validation. I was in Wyoming and I did a gig. And this had to be about 7-8 years ago, and I was the headliner, and it was at a Moose Lodge. I was the only black person in a 200-mile radius. I was like, where are your black people at? And they handed me the flyer with my picture on it, and it was crazy. And so I'm sitting there at the bar, and this Indian dude leans up from a distance, and he says, hey, brother. He's like, are you the headliner for the evening? And I said, yes, sir. He said, well, I'm going to need you to bring it tonight, brother. I'm not going to tell you why. I just need you to bring it. I need a laugh. I said, okay, I'm going to do the best I can. I hope you enjoy it. Nothing else was said after that. The show was awesome. Everybody killed it. After the show, so I'm selling merchandise, T-shirts, and everything after the show. The same Indian dude walks up to me, and he said, and now he's crying. He says to me, he said, you remember when I asked you to bring it before the show? And I was like, yes, sir. He said, You brought it, man. And he said, I asked you that because 2 days ago, my 17-year-old son committed suicide, and I needed to laugh. And you made me laugh, and I thank you. And he gave me a hug and a kiss.
Wow.
And so that's why I did that. So that's why I entertain, because it works.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Healing.
Well,
healing.
I appreciate what you're doing, and I also appreciate the fact that you're doing something, you're putting it out there to parents before they
mm-hmm.
decide to go into foster care. I mean, it actually maybe should be a requirement for parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
To look at this because you know, in some of the agencies you get a lot of, an agency that we worked with, we got a lot of training and we had good
mm-hmm.
training, but sometimes it wasn't from the perspective where we were, you know.
Having it brought
from your own perspective,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes our perspective isn't anywhere because we've never even seen anything like this. I hadn't even thought
mm-hmm.
about some of the things that happened to children who are in foster care. But as foster parents, I learned, and we did have ongoing training. So it was a good situation. But all foster parents aren't in that situation.
Mm-mm.
So something like this would be a valuable resource to
mm-hmm.
the agency. You know,
absolutely.
Like there's a Casey Family Program in San Francisco, if you heard of them, and a few others. That could benefit and use this as one of their trainings because,
mm-hmm.
as I say, it's from a different perspective than what they teach. And they do
absolutely
before. I don't know what they're doing now, but they did some good training, excellent training before. And it would also be maybe something you would also do with the CASA workers, CASA
mm-hmm.
workers.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And that's who it's targeted to. And it's not all negative. There's a story in there about a family, you know, that I call it the fairy tales do come true. And it's a family that I've met. I do motivational speaking as well. I go to, the last couple of years, I went to my childhood camp, and I go and talk about
mm-hmm.
bullying and projecting the person that you want to be. I met one of the kids there who was adopted, and he's from Guatemala, and he's one of
mm-hmm.
our stories in the film, and his parents are so
mm-hmm.
wonderful. His parents are the
mm-hmm.
daddy, the Annie family that I was looking for, and the daddy warbuck, and that whole thing. So we go through that fairy tale scenario, too, and there were some fears and apprehension there as well because it was an overseas adoption. So they tell you about their issues with that and how they went through it and would they
mm-hmm.
do it again and
mm-hmm.
how it is now and it comes
mm-hmm.
from the perspective of the child, their biological children. They have a biological child. We interview
her,
and you know, when you adopt, you also have to take into consideration your own children. You need to have that conversation with them, and so that they don't in turn ostracize the people that you're bringing in and behind your back, they making them feel like crap because that happened too.
Right.
You know.
Right.
I'm going to have to cut
you
short. We've got 2 minutes left. Our Block Talk is going to totally shut us down. So I just want to say thank you. Our caller, if anyone has something else to say, but to our caller who just spoke, I don't know if our guest should listen to you. Will you tell him your name, please?
This is Annie Turner.
Nice to meet
you.
Thank you.
That's Annie. I'm making a joke.
Well, thank you, Annie. I appreciate it. But
okay.
Tell a friend. Tell everybody. Let everybody know. Look for the film festivals. Look for anything that I just Google my name, Amaru the comedian.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I am.
Let's bring you local soon. So thank you so much, everyone.
We'll
be reconnected. Take care. Have a good one. God bless. And do something special for a child's heart.
I love you. Bye-bye.
Heavenly Mother, crying, these children are dying at the hands of the other child. Girl, her heart is breaking. Feel the earth is shaking. That river's flowing from the tears she cries. She cries.